SPA Aging in the 21st Century conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Sarah Craven. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm Sarah Craven with the UN Population Fund, and I'm going to be the moderator for today's call. And we're going to focus on the release of a new UNFPA report, which was written in collaboration with HelpAge International. This report is Aging in the 21st Century. We are very delighted to have three experts with us today to discuss this report, and after their opening statements, we will turn over the lines for a question and answer period. Our first speaker, we are going to hear from Dr. Jose Miguel Guzman. He received his PhD in demography from the University of Montreal and serves as the chief of the Population and Development Branch at the United Nations Population Fund. Jose Miguel, you may begin.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think the most important points from the report are mainly three. The first one is the world is quickly becoming much older. The second one is the population aging is both an opportunity and a major challenge. And the third one is that urgent action around population aging will be needed to leverage the opportunities and overcome the challenges. Let me go one by one to these three main messages coming from the report. In terms of the world is quickly becoming much older, we know that within the next 10 years, there will be 1 billion older persons worldwide. This unprecedented silent revolution of population aging is happening everywhere, but we also know that it's progressing faster in developing countries. By 2050, nearly 80% of the world older persons will live in developing countries. We can consider population aging as one of the most significant trends of the 21st century. The most important fact is not just that the world is becoming much older, but that the speed in developing countries is higher. And I think it's important to notice that in developing countries, the population of 60 and over will be growing close to 3.7% during this decade, and it's now in which we have the highest rate of population growth of older persons in the human history. The second point is that the population aging is both an opportunity and a major challenge. As you can see looking at the title of the report, we call a celebration and a challenge. Why we are taking the two sides of this equation? We consider that the demographic shift is a triumph of development that presents endless opportunities. Harnessing the contribution of socially economic active, secure, and healthy aging population can bring to societies will be key. Increasing longevity, that is one of the most important change that has the factor defining the aging of the population is one of the humanity's greatest achievements. Indeed, population aging is cause for celebration. We celebrate the fact that more people are living longer and healthier lives because improved nutrition, sanitation, medical advance, better healthcare, education, and economic well-being. But we all know that the opportunities come with challenges. And still, population aging also means an increased demand for income security, health, and long-term care, which creates huge social, economic, and cultural challenges that will need to be addressed with strong political and appropriate policies. The main challenge is to ensure that older people everywhere can benefit equally from the demographic shift. So that means some important investment in terms of economic security, health, and in terms of the environment in which older persons live. All these demands that will be created by the population aging imply that countries will have to face huge social, economic, and cultural challenges that need to be addressed. What are the actions? And this is the third point. We say that there urgent actions are needed to leverage the opportunity and challenge. I think this report shows that important progress has been made in many countries in adopting new policies, strategies, plans, and laws on aging. But the progress is still low. And many older persons all over the world, lack of economic security and access to affordable health care, many face discrimination, abuse, and violence. But what are those concrete actions that we are proposing in the report? First, it's important that all countries and governments and societies recognize the inevitability of population aging and the need to adequately prepare for the growing number of older persons. Second, there is an urgent need to guarantee income security and access to essential health and social services for other people. This requires a strong political commitment and planning now to implement the necessary reforms. Business as usual is not going to work. Investment in pension systems are seen as one of the most important ways to ensure economic independence and reduce poverty in old age. Social protection floors that ensure universal coverage must be implemented in order to guarantee income security and access to essential health and social service for all older persons. Older persons must have access to health care. A life course perspective to include promotion of healthy lifestyles from early ages, not just when people are older, as well as prevention activities that focus on maintaining independence and preventing and delaying disease and disability. An age-friendly physical environment which promotes the development and use of innovative technologies that encourage active aging is especially important as people grow older and experience diminished mobility and visual and hearing impairment. More must be done to expose, investigate, and prevent discrimination, abuse, and violence against older persons, especially women who are more vulnerable. And finally, we must involve everyone, including government, civil society, communities, families, and older persons themselves, to develop a new culture in which older persons are considered active members of their society and their contribution recognized and promoted. This is the main summary of the report.
Thank you very much, Jose Miguel. We are now going to hear from Richard Blewett, the Chief Executive Officer of HelpAge International. Richard previously worked for the International Federation of the Red Cross and the British Red Cross. We are delighted to have him here today, as HelpAge was the key partner and author on this new report. Richard?
Okay, I'll just compliment really what Jose and Miguel have said. I think the first message, to put it very simply, is many of the developing countries are aging four times faster than the United States aged. So they're aging before they grow rich, and they're aging before they have sufficient healthcare systems or social security in place. On a positive side, that's evidence of the success of development. Clean water, vaccination, it's enabling this very rapid aging situation to take place. We also see in many of the developing countries a very, high numbers of older people playing a caring role. In rural China, 52 million children are cared for by their grandparents as young people have migrated to the cities to find work. Many of the countries around the whole globe, we find increasingly aging farmers, which is a long-term issue in terms of food security for the globe. What the report, I think, says in terms of policy action is that in many, many countries of the world, there is still a mismanagement of aging. Governments are not really living up to the expectations of their senior citizens, and they could do a better job. What's needed there is long-term vision and strong political will and a clear sense of priorities. And why is that happening? I think in many countries, still older people are not seen sufficiently as assets. Economic assets, social assets, and therefore they're not engaged enough. Employment has to change. I know older people have to be enabled to retire when they want to retire, and discrimination needs to be reduced. It was very striking in the report that when older people were asked what are the biggest challenges they faced, 67% of them highlighted discrimination. We have a chapter in the report which is really about the voices of older people, where in 34 countries we specifically ran focus groups with older people, and there's a lot of very rich material there for people to have a look at and read and engage with to really pick up the nuanced view around how the globe is aging and what does it mean if you're an older person. However, I just want to end by saying there's also lots of good examples. There are countries that have tried to understand what a longevity dividend really means. How do you take the advantage of your aging population and actually turn that to an economic advantage, a social advantage? So, for instance, in South Africa, there's a great social pension. And if you're a granddaughter of a woman who has a social pension in South Africa, you're 3 centimeters taller. It reduces the stunting of grandchildren. In Brazil, 10 years ago, they put in place pretty strong human rights law to protect older people, and that certainly, again, reaps benefits for older people. In the United States, there's a great program called Experience Corps, where older people are engaged in tough schools, helping on basic literacy and numeracy. That's not only showed very concrete results for the children in terms of the educational outcomes, but equally there's evidence from John Hopkins that it's had advantages for the health of the older people themselves. And then lastly, I would highlight Japan, where we launched the report, where again, in the area of Alzheimer's and dementia, there's been a very progressive plan to, you know, try and make sure that the country can really manage that in a good and effective way.
Richard, I want to thank you for that. We're now going to hear from Dr. Martha Farnsworth-Ritchie. She has served as the director of the U.S. Census Bureau between 1994 and 1998 and is currently consults, writes, and lectures on demographic challenges and their effects on policies, programs, and products. And she will be discussing what this new report means for the United States. Marty?
Thank you, Sarah. Even though most of the growth in older people is in developing countries, by sheer numbers, the U.S. stands out. Only China has more people aged 80 and over. Population aging in the U.S. is a tremendous success story. It's because most Americans now live a full, long life rather than dying earlier in life. People tend to focus on the tip of the spear like more centenarians. But the increase in our older population is really because most of us are now living past age 60 and more of us to age 80 and beyond. So we're seeing rapid growth in our older age groups. Right now, nearly a fifth of Americans are 60 and over and 4% are 80 plus. By 2050, more than a quarter of Americans will be over 60 and 1 in 12 will be over 80. I'm sure you all know the big achievements in health are behind this success, but it's also a challenge. Starting off, study after study shows that few Americans are prepared for retirement. This suggests that Americans need to increase their work effort later in life. But work requirements are changing fast, and laid-off older workers are having a hard time getting a new job. Certainly, the implications for Social Security and Medicare are well known, since population aging is changing the dependency ratio. An aging population simply means more and more older Americans relative to younger ones compared to when those programs were designed. I think the gender gap in aging is less well known. Currently, the gap between women and men is moderate, but by 2050 it will be dramatic, especially for women 80 plus, because of expected increases in life expectancy. This is a concern because older women have less retirement income and fewer health benefits than men as they age, mostly because of the way their child-rearing roles intersected with paid work. So there are a lot of things we have to work on if we're going to get the longevity benefit. We need to think of education as lifelong, we need to address health care coverage, and we need to find ways to balance women's investment and work and family life.
Thank you for that, Marty. Okay, thank you all to all of our speakers for their opening statements. And now, operator, we can begin the question period.
At this time, to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Once again, that's star one to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to assemble the queue.
Okay, and while we're assembling the queue, I'd like to ask all the reporters who are asking a question to please identify yourself by giving your name and your news organization. You can also access this report at www.unfpa.org or www.helpage.org.
And we'll take our first question from Tony Best with New York Times.
Not the New York Times, the New York Carib News. I want to ask about the Caribbean, the picture of aging in the Caribbean, and if governments are doing enough to prepare people and prepare services for the aging population.
Okay, this is Richard. I can sort of just give some reaction to that. The general reaction, well, a country like Barbados has a pretty good social pension and pretty good health care and pretty much a good plan to try and keep older people in Barbados well and active and engaged. But basically, you find it more patchy in some of the other Caribbean islands in terms of the capacity of the government and its commitment to addressing its aging population. So I think it's not a clear, you know, picture across the Caribbean, and I think there's still a lot more that needs to get done.
I think if I can add something about that, I think we need to differentiate between the, you know, the Caribbean, because we have the case of Cuba, for example, that has a very high life expectancy, with, you know, good access to health of all the persons, and you have other countries that are not in the same situation. For example, the case of Haiti, we know that the demographic transition is less advanced there, and there are less programs related to the population of older persons that is smaller. And we have what is interesting also to show that in particularly in the English-speaking Caribbean countries and small islands, there are the life expectancy in most of them is very high. It's among the highest in all the regions, and I think this is an important consideration. The number of people is still not a big number because of the population of those countries not so big, but in terms of the life expectancy and other key indicators, the situation seems to be better than in mainland South America, for example, Central America.
And yeah, Richard, just one more comment would be, another thing that came through the survey in the Caribbean was the, in a number of the countries, the insecurity and how that affects daily life, and that certainly came through as another factor for some of the sort of Caribbean islands.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you have a follow-up question?
Yes, I do. I want to find out about the aging population among immigrants in the United States. If they are faring, the aged is faring as well as native-born Americans.
This is Marty. By and large, I haven't looked at the details in the report, but by and large, aging is pretty much the same across our whole population in the United States. Immigrants are aging just as non-immigrants are, and so they are part of the success story, but they're also part of the challenge.
Immigrant population, some immigrants doing better than other immigrants? Are immigrants from Latin America and the Caribbean faring worse? Does the report address that?
Well, the report is not specific in this analysis, but the evidence that in terms of the process of aging is that actually, migrants from Latin America, older person that become migrants that become older person while they are in the United States, they do relatively well comparing with their counterparts within the migration community.
Yeah.
And but I think the point here is what could happen in the future, because also the type of migration has changed, and the new generation of migrants. Could be different from the old generation of migrants that maybe was more selective. And there are some challenges there. And this is one point. The other point is that one of the issues that migrants face is that in some cases they are very much connected to their countries. When they become, when they retire, many of them go back to their countries of residence. But when they have some difficulty to health problems, they come back to U.S. And there are not any mechanisms to, for example, to make possible that people that are here have the insurance here can use that insurance in their countries. And this is something that maybe could be discussed. What are the possibilities to change, to make changes in that area that allow for people to use their insurance in other countries? They could this could, for example, reduce the cost of health care for all the person.
If I might add, by and large, there's a pretty direct connection between aging and somebody's level of education. People with more education tend to live longer lives.
Okay, thank you very much. Operator, do we have other calls, questions in the queue?
Yeah, we'll go to our next question from Connie Sexton with Arizona Republic.
Hi, this is Connie. Thank you so much for chatting with us about this report, and what this will do will bring to the forefront issues concerning the older population, but then it can fade away. And what happens, how do you get the voices of the older population to continue? Because they're often mobility issues where they just aren't out and about. Transportation, I think, is key, and just how do you reach, keep this message going, and so that they just aren't in the shadows?
Well, I'll take a sort of global, this is Richard, a perspective on that. I mean, on the 1st of October is the UN Day of Older People when we launched the report in Japan. But around the world in 65 countries, we have a global campaign called Age Demands Action. And that campaign is very localized in the sense of older people mobilizing themselves in their countries and their communities to stand up and talk to different groups, government, other civil society actors, to pay attention to the particular challenges of being old and the opportunities, and they want to get engaged in civic life and things. So definitely the activism and voice issue for us is a really key element of enabling positive active aging. And it needs to be continuously worked on. Those spaces have to be provided, and some sort of structures, community structures to support that.
If I might add, this is Marty, one of the things that's helpful is to look at some of the good examples, interesting examples that are in the report, and try to duplicate them. I myself saw an interesting example a few years ago. It was a city in South Australia, and I can't remember the name of it, but they had a community-wide planning process as to what kinds of developments they needed to do around transportation. I mean, for the community as a whole. And almost as an afterthought, they invited older representatives of older people to be there. And one very simple thing that came up because they had that representation was that people needed more time, pedestrians needed more time to cross the street. In other words, to run the street lights with a longer green light time. Things like that come up if there's inclusion. And I think that alone, including older voices in all kinds of planning, has a big payoff.
Can I add something, Jose Miguel? I think that we must expect that the society will adjust to the new demographic structure that we have. But this could take time. And I think in the case of the situation for the person, I don't think they can wait too much in terms of timing, in terms of just waiting for the society to adapt to the new reality. And this is why it is required that we really contribute to the mobilization of the civil society through the media, through different channels. We are trying to do the same within United Nations, because even within our own organization, the issue of aging needs to be mainstream, needs to be considered as part of the discussion. For example, in terms of what will happen after the what we call the post-2015 development agenda, when the MDGs period will finish. But it required a participation of everyone at the community level, at the cities, at the country level, and the different actors need to be mobilized in terms of really making visible not just the situation of older person in terms of what they need, their current needs, but in terms also of what will be the future. The reports say, for example, that the best investment we can make is to prepare to invest in the younger generation. If we invest in terms of promoting working opportunities, higher education, this population will be better prepared to face aging in the future. So I think what we try to propose in the report is a more comprehensive approach in which the issue of aging needs to be seen as a more integrated issue, not as something that just refers to people over 60, over 65, over 70.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Well, it does also point to the fact that the report shows that they feel such discrimination. So how do you empower them to keep speaking and standing up for themselves? Do you think that will just grow as the different generations become older, that there's a different mindset in the whole social media? Is that going to help contribute to the unification of the different age groups?
This is Richard. I mean, I think two things. One is definitely the media have a huge role to play in projecting the strength of older people. And I think if you look at the baby boomers in the US, you know, many of them, of course, in their old age are incredibly active and are contributing. And actually, the financial flows are downwards, not upwards. You know, they're actually contributing to their grandchildren's education. You know, so there's a lot of making sure the right story gets told. You know, when I get to hear of this thing called the intergenerational war and conflict, I don't see that in communities anywhere around the world, in the rich world, the developing world. It doesn't seem to play out in reality. So making sure that there are proper thought-through arguments and projection, you know, in the media and presenting older people and enabling their voice to be heard is really, really crucial.
If I might add, in the United States, I've seen this at firsthand in a number of occasions. I helped, for instance, to launch a magazine called Self, which was the first successful mass market magazine for women 40 and older. And what happens is that people in the media are, in this country at least, are disproportionately young. And that's also in the advertising. And there are just a lot of assumptions that are characteristic to a given age group. If we had a more balanced approach, I mean, when we have a workforce that is balanced among young and old, we don't have those kinds of bias, just unconscious biases. And so that's a specific thing for the media to be thinking about.
Thank you. Do we have a next question in the queue?
Yes, we'll go to our next question from Josh Letterman with Associated Press.
Hi, thanks for doing the call. Can you talk a little bit more about the gender gap, specifically in the United States, new data that is revealed in the report that deals with this? And also, you talked about needing to find ways to balance women's investment and work and family life. What are those ways, and what does this mean for public policy?
Well, let me start off and see if anybody else has anything to add. But certainly, our gender gap is actually not as pronounced as in many other countries because we do have more men and women with a longer life expectancy. So right now, the sex ratio of in the United States, sex ratio of women men per 100 women is 80. There's 80 men per 100 women, 60 plus, and there's 57 men per 100 women at 80 plus. But because life expectancy at birth and life expectancy at age 60 continues to be growing for women more than for men, that's why this gap will grow as we have more older people. The thing that I think is really key in thinking about this is that right now, amongst Americans 60 and over, 3 out of 4 men are married, but fewer than half of the women are married. So they have essentially taken time out of their work life to raise the family and the children, but as you know, they tend to marry men who are older than they are. So they come into widowhood. They come into old age quite often widowed, and of course nowadays many are divorced too. So a lot of planning for women had been traditionally that they would have a share in their husband's pension, they would be supported by their husband's retirement money, Social Security, pension, that they would be living with their children possibly. But, you know, as you know, people are having smaller families and have been doing so for some decades now. So it's a real issue, especially for minority women. That's where we see the lone, older, elderly woman. And so I think that the issues of making it easier for women to combine family and children, which we see a lot of young people concerned about right now, the people who are having their children, those things will make a difference as we go forward. But, you know, we've got, there's all the people that are aging right now and in the next 20, 25 years.
Just, yeah, this is Richard. I can't talk in detail about the U.S., but my overall perception, I've worked on aging now for 6 years, having in the past worked for children's NGOs around the world, and I've come to the conclusion that somehow around the world we don't care for our grandmothers. There's something that is deeply gendered that stops the action to really addressing aging properly, and that's a real problem. You know, 3/4 of the people on the planet have no social security, and a good number of them are women, and we don't seem to care about that. Half of the world's AIDS orphans are cared for by their grandmothers, and largely their grandmothers, and we again don't seem to actually then put in place actions to address it. And then lastly, of course, in many contexts around the world, the carer of the older person is an older person themselves, and again, the vast majority of the carers are women. And the care economy is far too much in the shadows. We don't have enough policy action to really protect and support the carers and value, show the economic value of that work.
Yeah, I think that that's certainly true in this country. We have, and starting in 2000, in the census, we started asking people for the first time, are you the major carer, for, are you raising your grandchildren, because the phenomenon had become so common. Certainly around the world, one big issue is land ownership. Women often do not hold land in their own names, and more often than not, and quite often, the husband's family comes to recuperate it, and the woman is on her own. We don't have that in this country, but that's an example of the kind of issue that we face, and I think we've always seen this. I was at a conference last week with one of the major historians in this country. He's written about the Salem witch trials. And one of the things that came up is how older, single, unprotected women were always the ones accused of witchcraft. And this actually, there's actually an example of that in the report. So I think that, you know, different, there are different manifestations, but this is a long-standing historical issue.
If I may add something in terms of the gender differences, I think it's important to notice that even if the life expectancy is higher for female than for male, and the prevalence of disability by age after 50 years old is higher for women. So I think this is very important, and this is related to some factors, some risk factors that are higher for women. For example, the low physical activity is higher in women than in men. The same for hypertension. So I think there are some factors that are also making that the situation of women is not the, is worse than the situation of men in all the ages, independently that the women are living longer.
Okay, thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Well, if you could just be a little bit more specific about the policy implications. I mean, other than saying we need to make it easier for these women, well, what can governments or societies do specifically that would take steps in that direction?
I think
there's a lot of, you know, there's a long-standing agenda for women when they are at the, say, in their 25, 40, you know, child-rearing ages, on child care, and that really hasn't gone anywhere in the United States except at certain companies that have decided that it's worth providing child care so that they can keep their children. The, I mean, I know you're aware that in Scandinavia, those countries are quite a bit advanced, and really women do not pay the child penalty that they pay in the United States. There is some, I'm not saying that it's perfect, but because women in those countries are more likely to be in occupations like teaching and government where they don't have to work late or stay late, but they do have quite equitable benefits in terms of the husband as well. So child caring is really becoming much less gender gendered in those countries particularly, and to the, in this country to a certain extent than it has been in the past. But certainly, I mean, employment in this country is the bottom line. That's where people make their money. That's where they presumably can put money away for savings and for pensions. And, of course, that's simply a huge issue, the pension issue. My understanding is that California right now is considering starting a state pension, that there's a bill that I think has gotten through one part of the legislature, and they are looking at what they could do so that all Californians who don't have a retirement benefit from their employer, which, as you know, is now more than half, I think, will have another way to retire, to put some money away for retirement. So, I mean, all those pension and savings initiatives are key, and then the balancing out the work and family. Letting women both have children and earn the money they need so that they can age gracefully and happily. Those are, I'd say, the two biggest things. One thing I would like to mention, though, is that there's a lot of research on how money is exchanged within the family. And most people don't realize it, but the flows of money and care tend to be from older to younger, not the other way around. And maybe this is an example of the media bias I mentioned earlier, that the media, being younger people, think in terms of what younger people are doing for older people. I recall a survey AARP did a couple of years ago where they asked both the adult children and the adult parents about the help that went on between the two of them, and the adult parents actually said a lot of the help they got from their children was not something they wanted. So there's some intergenerational issues here too.
Thank you. Could we have the next question in the queue, please?
We'll take our next question from Clyde Haberman with New York Times.
Good afternoon. Write a column on New York, so I guess this is going to be a little self-interested. Are there any facets about aging populations that are manifested by special problems for those living in large cities?
Well, certainly the mobility issue is very big, but I'll let Richard talk more broadly.
Okay, I mean, two things. One is, it'd be interesting. I think New York City has gone through a process of giving leadership to being an age-friendly city, which means a city friendly for older people, but friendly for people of all ages. The extent to which that really has impacted, it started 3 or 4 years ago, as it really had an impact on seniors in New York, is a question which needs to be looked at. But I think some good things have been done. One of the key issues around the world, though, in the urban environments is security. You know, in many particularly very large, fast-growing urban environments, insecurity and just the difficulty of moving around because the urban environment is still not properly built are two major factors that older people talk about a lot.
Yeah, I think what I've heard from people in New York particularly is, they might have a very nice small or large or medium-sized apartment that they've gotten for themselves, and they love being in the city. But once they start having mobility problems, life changes altogether.
Ms. Lou, when you said some good things are being done, can you cite a few examples?
Well, definitely there was an investment in benches, investments in listening to older people, in the process of actually taking forward age-friendly New York. So things like the traffic light system changing to enable people to cross the crossings of the very last large roads in New York. I don't have the complete list, but there was a large action plan. And I think, again, it would be just very interesting a few years on to know, if you went back to older people in New York and asked them, has life changed, to see whether, in fact, they feel that there's been some real progress.
Thank you. And just one follow-up, if I may, not specifically on what I was just asking, but clearly the issues of Medicare and Social Security loom very large in this presidential election we're having. Does this report play into that at all?
Well, I'll just make a stab at that. It's hard to say how it would play out. Certainly, I think it says this isn't going away. We've all talked about, I think both candidates talked last night about the delays in addressing the fact that these systems were designed in a time when we did not have such a large older population. We haven't responded to that. And that's been on the table for a long time. I didn't hear that really being addressed in a concrete way last night, more in a symbolic way. So I'm not sure exactly, Clyde, where this is going to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly, this is Richard. On a global level, I think, you know, the challenge in the rich world is social security systems need to be reformed, retirement ages need to be adjusted, people need to be enabled to work if they want to work into old age. But in the developing world, social security systems need to be built,
right.
Modest social security, so that older people have some form of income security, because the family is no longer the solution in many, many parts of the world, or the sole solution. And then on healthcare, you know, the general message, I think, from the report is, you know, invest in keeping older people well,
right,
and enabling them to remain active, because that's the most cost-effective thing to do, let alone the most humane thing to do. And so what you want is a healthcare system that is person-centric, not medical-centric, and that is, you know, and that probably will help also manage some of the cost issues.
Yeah, we did hear that last night from President Obama, that he's talked about how investing in preventive care was cost-effective, and that certainly is true for older people. Somebody has a fall and a hip needs a hip replacement and can't walk around. I mean, it's a huge difference in their situation and in their need for caregiving. We also heard President Obama say, and I didn't hear Mr. Romney contradict him, that Social Security is a different issue, and it certainly is. It is in the sense that it just needs a couple of tweaks, and Obama mentioned how they had been tweaked under Reagan and I think Alan Greenspan, who was the chair of the commission, successfully in the 1980s, and it just needs that again. But people have to agree to do it. I mean, those are really two separate issues, Social Security and Medicare.
Thank you. Go ahead, Richard.
Sorry, Jose Miguel. If I can add something in relation to this issue, I think it's important that when we talk about other person, we talk about just sometimes as just a homogeneous category. And actually, one important issue is inequality. And even in developing countries, we have in developing countries a proportion of the population that is not so high, but that has economic security. But the issue is that it's very small percentage of the population, because the rest of the population is not linked to any social security system, any social protection system. So I think when dealing with this issue, both in terms of income security and health access, we need to consider what is the level of inequality that prevail in each of the countries. Because what we observe, and is said also in the report, is that there are differences among other persons in terms of the capacity to access, to have such economic security, but also that because the societies in which we live now are unequal, this inequality will be projected to the future. Unless we do something, what we are going to have also is the future with an important proportion of people living in poverty and without having access to those services. So I think that it's not just to think in terms of what happened now, but also to think in how we are projecting our society in terms of the economic participation of people, in terms of how well distributed is the access to resources, and how this can impact the future.
Thank you. Operator, do we have the next question in the queue?
At this time, there are no other questions in queue.
Okay. Well, I'll ask, take my privilege as a moderator. I guess I'll ask all of you, what did you find to be the most surprising finding in this report? Something, having worked on these issues, that you were surprised to learn?
Well, I guess I would say that the most surprising issue for me, even though I read these data all the time, was the extent to how much this is occurring in developing countries. And particularly, the report brought home how the investment in whatever country you're looking at, we have to invest in making sure that people can work and that they learn what they need to learn in a lifelong way. I don't think lifelong learning anymore is just something we're talking about in the United States, but it needs to be all over the world.
I think
in
terms of the report, even if we were the main responsible for preparing the report, we, you know, by doing the report, we found some interesting things. One of them, I think, is the fact that there is progress, and so there is hope. And countries are doing changes, institutional changes, changes in policies, and changes in laws. Even in African countries, that many people think, oh, they have to care about older person because there are very young societies. But even in many sub-Saharan African countries, they are investing now, and I think this is very positive. And I think, but maybe on the negative side, what I think is that what is missing is the lack of changes of good practices and experiences among countries. This is something that surprised me to see that many countries, they are investing without really looking what other countries have done, what worked, what didn't work, which is the proof that using this kind of intervention will produce this result. So I think this is something that is there, and I think it's one of the huge challenges for the future, is to try to define what are the best interventions in the different situations, and based on evaluation that really are statistical, you know, based on statistics, on good quantitative analysis to define really what worked and what doesn't work.
Yeah, this is Richard. I would just say that I think the report sort of inspires us as the co-authors to imagine whether some form of global index on aging can be built that gives a very analytic tool to help policymakers understand what's going on aging around the world, and like Jose Miguel says, that experience can then be shared. The other thing, I think the one thing that surprised me was the extent of neglect and difficulty we face around the issues of older people in emergency settings. And it doesn't matter whether it's the tsunami in Japan, New Orleans, or a developing country that's facing a conflict or a natural disaster. Still factoring in older people and making sure that, again, they can be empowered, enabled, and properly supported, there's a huge gap, and that's a gap that we're going to have to work on in the years to come.
Great. Operator, do we have any more calls in queue? Questions in queue?
At this time, there are no other questions.
Okay. Well, I would like to thank everyone for calling in today. I'd like to thank our three speakers for giving us their time and sharing with us this new report. Again, you can see it at www.unfpa.org or www.helpage.org. Again, we'd like to thank you for participating today and look forward to any follow-up. Please be in touch with us. And I'll give the speakers one more chance if there's any last comments you'd like to make in closing.
I think I would just like to reiterate the issue of the media being educated on this issue. I think that we were talking a little bit ago about Social Security, and I think the media tends to buy into people thinking it's the same problem as Medicare is, rather than the simple fixes that everyone knows what they need to be but just can't agree on them.
Hello?
Yes, nothing from my side.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing from.
All right. Well, thank
you.
Thank you so much. Thank you to all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That concludes today's conference call. We appreciate your participation.